Last lecture, we were left in the middle of computing the spectrum of a free massless scalar in two dimensions, quantified on a circle. So we're considering a cylindrical geometry for space-time, where space was a circle, and there was some Euclidean time, and some complex variable. Okay, with periodicity 2 pi I. We expanded the scalar field in modes. We wrote down the commutation relation for the modes. This is how the modes are related to the currents associated to translation of the scalar field. And I also wrote down a definition for the stress tensor, for the quantum mechanical stress tensor. Two-point splitting regularization. Right, as you remember, the spectrum on the circle consists of a bunch of operators. A bunch of states, which are momentum modes for the center of mass, for the zero mode of the scalar field, and then on top of this, you can build an infinite tower of other states. Okay, now the place I would like to, and we're in the middle of computing the energy of these states through the stress tensor. Now, by definition, pretty much, the energy of a state is the integral over sigma of t tau tau perhaps with some 2 pi's thrown in. Well, there are probably some 2 pi factors that I'm ignoring, but different conventions. Anyway, t tau tau can be written as t s s plus t s bar s bar. Remember, this is the expression for t s s. Recall that t s s bar, at least in flat space, vanishes. Similarly, I can write down the momentum of a state. Okay. So they're computed from the zero nodes of the stress tensor, holomorphic and anthropomorphic parts of the stress tensor. Now, I would like to write down an expression for the stress tensor acting on a state. So let me take this and expand it out in modes. I will generally denote just with T the holomorphic components of the stress tensor. So I have a sum over N, a sum over M, A of N, A of M, e to the minus n plus m s And then subtracting 1 over minus s prime squared. Now, when acting on a state, when you have infinite sums and things like that, it's convenient to first add to states which lower the energy, and then with states raise the energy. That will make sure that most of this infinite sum actually drops out in a calculation in relation to something finite. So I'm going to rewrite this. It's the same sum, but normal ordered. Now, when I normal order, the difference between normal order expression and the normal expression can only be seen when these two operators don't commute, and when this is positive and this is negative. So the terms I'm missing are a sum over n greater than 0 of the commutator between a n and a minus n, which is the same as n, e to, and then, sorry, here I made a mistake. I meant to write this here too. I was, okay. So here I have e to the minus ns plus ns prime, and then minus 1 over s minus s prime squared. Okay? Now this expression, this part of the expression is now perfectly fine as s approaches s prime. When you act on any state, this gives you some polynomial, it gives you something well defined, which has no divergences. The cancellation of divergences comes from the comparison between these two pieces. So this sum, is a well-known sum, something like e to the s prime minus s plus 2 e to the 2 s prime minus s, and so on. You can convince yourself easily that this is the same as e to the 1 over, I'll write it properly. What is it? Oh, yes. E to the s plus s prime over e to the s minus e to the s prime squared. And so we're left with the computation of this limit as s prime goes to 0. As s goes to s prime. Okay. And this gives minus 1 over 24. Sorry, what I mean is the limit as s prime goes to s of this expression is minus 1 over 24. So we can expand this as minus 1/2 sum of, or n sum over m of normal ordering of an am e to the minus n plus m s minus 1 over 24. Now it's convenient to collect together all the Fourier modes. So I write this as sum of ln e to the minus ns minus 1 over 24. Well, now ln is defined as one half. Yes, I had made a sign mistake here, because remember, the A's are what appears in I, dx. I'm sorry. So I was supposed to actually have a minus sign here. And I wonder if the minus sign must have propagated somewhere. Okay, there is just one sign mistake here, but I know the answer.
To the second term?
Hmm?
And the second term?
Yes, and the second term too.
Yeah, but I mean the second one?
Hmm?
You mean probably the second term in the same one?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out if I also got that sign wrong, and indeed I did.
Okay, and then must have been two that, so here there was a minus. So it must have been true that this was 1 over 24. Okay. So now, okay, there is a plus indeed. So I can get rid of that. Okay, so the Fourier modes of the stress tensor are going to be simply this. Okay. So the Fourier mode of the stress tensor are important. You probably met them already in the conformal field theory class. They're called Virasoro generators. See, in the same way as I was mentioning, these two halves of the current are actually separately conserved and remain conserved if you multiply them by any holomorphic function, so that each of these operators is actually conserved charge. The same is true here. So all of these operators generate symmetries of the theory. We can see it just by looking how do they act, say, on the scalar field. So it's easy to compute the commutator between a Virasoro generator and a mode of the scalar field. So now, plugging this into that, you can find that Ln acts on dsx as ds e to the n s dsx. Which is essentially the same as saying that L acts on x as e to the ns dsx. So see, L is acting on the scalar field as a conformal coordinate transformation, as an infinitesimal coordinate transformation with defined by this scalar, by this vector field. So these Virasoro generators act as coordinate transformations. They're a symmetry of the theory. They're not a symmetry of the states of the theory, meaning that if you take any of these states, typically, for example, these states are going to be annihilated by all the L's with positive n, but they're surely not annihilated by the L's with negative n, because those are made out of A's with negative index, so they will create other states.
What do you mean by typically? You say if you look at these states, they're typically going to be annihilated by A, by L, and...
Let me precise.
That's only true for
higher states. We said that An of P, I meant really those states I was pointing at, vanishes for N greater than 0. Then from the definition of L follows that Ln P also vanishes for n greater than zero. We can also check what L0 does on P. I get a nice contribution from 1/2 a squared, a zero squared. So this is p squared over 2. now, if you're acting on, because of these commutation relations, if you act with L0, say, on a minus 1 p, you're going to get p squared over 2 plus 1. And so on and so forth. You get p squared over 2 plus some integer, depending on how much deeper did you went into the model. And you can compute also the action of L's. So in order to compute the action of L's on any of these vectors, you can just write the L's in terms of A's and use the commutation relation of the A's. Now, for example, you can compute, I don't know, L minus 1 on P. This is going to be A minus P, A minus 1, P, for example. So, as you mentioned, in general, in conformal field theory, there are special names for operators, for states which are annihilated by positive modes of Virasoro. They're called highest weight states. Given a highest weight state, you can build a whole tag of states by acting with Virasoros with negative modes. something which is obtained this way is called a descendant. Very soon, descendants which are also primaries, which are also highest weights, will play an important role. Okay, now, the only thing I'm missing here is the Virasoro algebra, meaning the algebra generated by these modes. So I would like to compute what is, I would like to compute the commutator between Ln and Lm. Now, doing so from these infinite sums is, again, a bit of a mess, which would require regularization of some infinite sum of positive integers or something like that. But there is an easier way to go, which is to, at least a more convincing way to go, perhaps, which is to just compute first this expression just by using a chain rule from that. So you're going to get something like I ds, I think there is a typo in equation 42 of the notes because I don't think the I is there. I should probably be careful with the order of things. Sorry. Okay. Now you can take this expression and send S to S prime. More precisely, right. So you might worry that this will be singular. But it's actually not the case. So if you look at the singularity between these two, let me just put them together in the parentheses. It helps. As I send S to S prime, this will have a singularity. It goes like 1 over s minus s prime squared. So now we're asking, so the overall singularity of this expression looks like this. And you can convince yourself that it does have a finite limit. Anyway, so starting from here, doing the limit carefully, you can get to the final answer. So you can get to the action of Ln on the stress tensor, first of all. And then you expand this in Fourier modes, and you get the final answer for the Virasoro algebra. Now, you might observe that if you forget about this, this is precisely the algebra of vector fields. Of this type of vector fields. But somehow, quantum mechanically, we got an extra piece here. This extra piece is closely related to the presence of a Weyl anomaly. It's the way the theory is telling you that there is an anomaly for Weyl transformations. See, we are sure that, again, if all the numerical, all these 1 over 24 and 1 over 12 were missing from here, then T would transform under this transformation just as a tensor with two indices. So if I hide these pieces, this would be just the transformation under a diffeomorphism, under a vector field, of a stress tensor, of a spin two tensor. But there is this extra stuff. Now, suppose I wanted to turn on a non-trivial metric on my surface. At the leading order, turning on, changing the metric is controlled by the stress tensor. So in order to change the metric, I could sort of add to the action something like TSS delta H SS plus complex conjugate. This would change the metric a little bit from flat. But then, now this expression would be perfectly invariant under diffeomorphisms and well defined globally on the surface if this transforms as a stress, as a tensor with two indices under coordinate transformations. But it doesn't. Which means that once I turn on a non-trivial metric, something goes wrong in the invariance under a combination of diffeomorphisms and Weyl transformations. Okay. So in general, for a generic conformal field theory, you always find an expression like this for the Virasoro algebra, except that you have some constant here called the central charge. So for the we learn for the scalar field, the central charge is 1. Okay, so I know that you probably saw a lot of this already in the conformal field theory class, and in particular, you probably know how to compute this using more elegant methods than this. simply by computing the OPE of the stress tensor with itself. But the OPEs are very powerful, but it's useful to keep in mind how would you possibly derive this sort of results just using standard quantum field theory methods, at least for a free theory. Yes?
So I know how to derive this from the OPE of the energy stress, the stress energy and of T with T.
That's right.
If you do that, is there a way to actually determine C as well? Because if you do it like this, you actually determine the
stress charge. Yes. So when you compute the OPE of the stress tensor with itself, so let's do it with the OPE technology. So with OPE technology, we would have said dx, z, dxw equal 1 over z minus w squared. And here I probably have a sign mistake. Yes, minus. Okay. Now you want to compute the OPE of t with t. So you're computing the OPE of dx, z, dxz with dxw, dxw. When you do that, the first term in your OPE comes from contracting everything with everything. And you get 1 over z minus w to the fourth plus t over z minus w squared plus the t to the t over z minus w plus dot, dot, dot. Now, when you convert this OPE statement into a commutation relation statement, this or this, then this one produces this one. So literally, when you expand this out, okay. So this is pretty much all that we need about the theory of a free scalar field. If you have any more questions about this theory, this is a good time to ask them. Okay. Yeah, I should perhaps remark again, the meaning of this is a Casimir energy. It's the energy of the vacuum on the circle. Now, I would like to take this information about the scalar field theory and produce the spectrum of string theory. Now, if I ignore for a moment ghosts and subtleties of pH fixing, essentially, the propagation of the string was controlled by just 26 or how many dimensions you have of these scalar fields. So you might think that to get the string spectrum, you would just take the same expression just for 26 scalar fields. Now this is almost correct, but not quite, because we should remember that when we gauge fixed weights and degrees of freedom, we cannot forget about their equations of motion. So this is a fun statement, even classically. See, we didn't remark it, but we did something quite cool in one of the previous lectures. We learned how to find extrema surfaces in flat space. Because we learned that we learned how to extremize the area of a surface in flat space. We said, okay, we can rewrite this extremization problem to an extremization of the sort of square root of h, ab, dA, x mu, dx, mu, eta, mu, nu. And then we can gauge fix to just get a free free quadratic action. Now, does it mean that we can find an extremal surface for every solution of the equation, of the Laplacian equation? No, because we should remember that although the metric drops out, the equation of motion of the matrix are still there. So the equation of motion that you get from this action must be supplemented with a constraint. Now the variation of this action with respect to the matrix is by definition the stress tensor. So this should be supplemented by the constraint that the stress tensor vanishes. Now, if you solve this set of equations, then you will find extremal surfaces in class space. So you solve this Laplacian, this is the linear equation, but then on top of it, you have some quadratic constraints. Now, quantum mechanically, you cannot quite set an operator to zero. Now, if you remember the quantization of gauge fields, there was some similar constraint that had to be implemented. And there is a way to implement it by hand and a way to do it properly. The way to implement it by hand was the Gupta-Bleuler quantization, where you took whatever operator you wanted to set to zero, decompose it into creation and annihilation operators, and only required that the annihilation operators kill the physical states. That was enough to make sure that on averages this operator would drop out. It's not a great way to do things because it's hard to make sure that the states that you're throwing out will not be produced by interactions. A much better way to do things is to use the BRST quantization, which gives a very systematic way to throw away and physical states and make sure they stay away. But BRST quantization will be the topic of Monday's lecture. Today I would like to do things by hand. So let me see. So I want to take, so my starting point is the Hilbert space of 26 free bosons. Okay, so my initial Hilbert space consists of states P mu, labeled as 26 momenta.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, you probably said this at some point, but can you say really quickly again why 26 is the number?
I prefer to say this on Monday.
Okay.
So for now, we do things by hand, and so there are two integers that we cannot get by doing things by hand. You can only get them by doing things properly, BRST quantization or some other technique. These two numbers are the total number of dimensions and the correct Casimir energy of the vacuum, because the Casimir energy also received contributions from the metric degrees of freedom that we are gauge fixing away.
So
those two numbers, take them as given today,
okay,
and tomorrow. On Monday, we'll do better. So we have now oscillators, A mu, so can everybody see this part of the blackboard? No, I thought so. It's a bit too deep, isn't it? Okay, let me just use the middle blackboard. Should be better. So I want to generalize those expressions for 26 objects. And I want to do it in a Lorentz invariant fashion. So I had to put an eta mu nu here. Now, this is a little troublesome, because if I define things like this, and then I define my states in the obvious way, my Hilbert space does not have positive norm. Why? Because if I compute the simplest inner product and I use these commutation relations, I get this answer. So the oscillators which are space-like create positive states, positive norm states. But the time-like oscillator creates a negative norm state. Now, we should not panic, because we've seen this happen. You must have seen this happen also when you're quantizing gauge fields. When you quantize a vector boson, a boson which has one Lorentz index, the same thing happens. If you want to quantize in a Lorentz invariant way, the modes of the time-like component of the boson create negative norm states. Indeed, as I said, a string gives rise to the infinite tower of particles. This mode of the string is pretty much these are pretty much the modes of a scalar field. These can be thought of as the modes of a vector boson, and so on and so forth. So we need to hope that there is some gauge. Yes?
Professor, those negative norm states appear in 26 dimension? Because
in any dimension.
Because, Professor, when we calculate this 26 dimension, as you said, you will do it in Monday. They consider that 26 when there is no norms.
I'm just discussing the Hilbert space of the scalar theory, of the 26 scalar fields, not the Hilbert space of string theory. So I'm saying, on top of this Hilbert space, now we need to impose constraints. Hopefully, these constraints will eliminate all the negative norm states, in the same way as the gauge theory constraints get rid of the time-like component of the negative norm states in gauge theory. So I'm going to impose the following constraints. I'm going to require physical states to be killed by positive modes. First of all, so physical states will be highest weight. I will also have to impose that they are killed by L0, by the zero mode of the stress tensor. Well, the zero mode of the stress tensor is L0 minus the Casimir energy. As I was saying, at this point, we cannot compute the Casimir energy because of the contributions from the ghosts. But I can just tell you that the correct answer is this. In a similar way, on brass,
what exactly do you mean by physical state in terms of like the gauge fixing or?
I mean a state which is an actual state of the string theory rather than just a state of the quantum field theory on the worksheet. So classically, that would mean if I try to use the classical equation of the string to determine what is a possible range of motion of a string. The first thing I can do is to solve these equations. Okay, this gives me a possible set of solutions. These are not actually solutions of the original problem. there are solutions of the regional problem only if I also impose this constraint. So physical solutions will be solutions of these equations which satisfy this constraint. A neat property of this constraint is that if it holds at some time, it holds at any other time, because the stress tensor is conserved. That's why I call it a constraint and not an equation of motion. If you have some initial configuration of your string, you should check that it satisfies this constraint, and then you can time evolve it. It might have been fun actually to see this happening already for the free part, for the particles. In the first lecture, I was doing particles before I did strings. You could ask, what is the constraint that follows from the equation of motion for this one-dimensional metric? The constraint turns out to be that just p squared equal to m squared. So in that situation, the constraint would have been that the particle is on shell, the external particle. So anyway, we had this constraint on physical states. Now, some of these physical states will actually be null and orthogonal to all other physical states. Suppose that I have a physical state which satisfies all these relations, but it is also L minus 1, say, of some other state. Then if I look at the inner product between a physical state and the null state, this will be 0, because the minus 1 is killing the physical state. So the Hilbert space has two interesting space subspaces, the subspace of physical states and the subspace of null states. And they might potentially intersect. So the space of states of the string is going to be the space of physical states modulo the space of physical states, which are also null. So you did this also already in gauge theory, and you're quantizing QED. Again, we'll do it better next week when we do BRST quantization. So this is the space of states. So now let's try to see some examples. So I think I have 15 minutes, that's good. So let's first look at this class of states. When are they physical? Well, they're automatically killed. We know that they are all highest weight, so that's good. Maybe I should ask other questions. There probably are questions. Feel free to ask the questions. So this is a bit of a ad hoc procedure, okay? The correct way would be to do BRST quantization. BRST quantization is a way to sort of add some extra degrees of freedom which cancel the which carefully cancel the physical degrees of freedom. Anyway, so this is an ad hoc way to do things. I'm going to give you now examples of physical states and of null states. These physical states are the correct way to quantize. This prescription is the correct way to quantize this semi-classical statement. So if you do this, the state. And here will be the quantization of solution of these equations and this constraint. Actually, I should just say solution of these constraints. But and also, if you want to understand this better, I invite you to just open again Peskin and Schroeder or whatever textbook you used for the previous courses and look at QED. And as a preparation for next Monday, you might want to give a look at the Beresti quantization of electrodynamics. I will do everything from scratch, but you know, just getting a feeling might be useful. So these states are already highest weights. The only thing I need to check if it's, they satisfy p squared equal to L0 minus 1 equal to 0, which, because of the definition of L0, means that they are physical if p squared equal to 2. Remember, we are using conventions where there are most classes in the metric. So that's not nice. These states correspond to a tachyon. So the simplest state you can find in the string Hilbert space, in the bosonic string Hilbert space, is a tachyonic scalar field. This is essentially telling you that bosonic string is not really stable. You can try to define it perturbatively, but there is non-perturbatively, at the very least, you're expanding around the wrong vacuum. Nobody knows what the correct vacuum would be. When we move on to superstrings, we'll find string theories which do not have this state. But let's move on. Now, next, you could try to look at some state that looks like A minus 1 on P. Now, this is not going to work. It's not going to work because, although, of course, I did not write it, I had similar constraints for L bars. Which means that my states better have the same as L0 as they have L0 bar. Now, this was automatically true here for P. But once you start with A minus 1, you're shifting the value of L0, but not the one of L0 bar. So what you really need to do is to put both an A and an A bar. Now, when are these physical? These are physical when p squared minus 2 plus 1 minus 1 equals to 0, which means p squared equal to 0. Now, this is nice. It's nice because these are massless, massless particles with two indices, with two Lorentz indices. What do I mean with this? I mean, these modes of the string are identical to the modes you would find if you were to look at a graph at a scalar field with two Lorentz indices, which is massless. This is good because massless fields with indices are the sort of things that have gauge symmetries, and which for which the sort of negative norm states can be gotten rid of. So anyway, so these are the physical states. Now we should check which one are null.
Mm-hmm. Isn't this a huge problem of the theory that bosonic strings are unstable and not perturbative?
Yeah, bosonic string is not a good theory. So when we talk about string theory, we actually talk about fermionic string, which does not have this state. But as a toy model, bosonic string is useful because you can still do perturbation theory. Mm-hmm. Question? No. Any questions? So these states are physical. They are always never null. Yeah, they cannot be obtained by from something else by asking with L minus 1. On the other hand, these ones can very well be null. I can get a state like this by... Let me always put some polarization vectors. This will help. Okay? Some, I'm going to consider some linear combination of these states. When is that this can be null? Well, if I look at, for example, M minus 1 acting on... that name. On a state like this, I will get P mu E nu minus one mu A mu bar. Okay, so null states are states for which the polarization vector is proportional, has one leg proportional to P. And this should remind you of a photon, but it has two indices. What could these fields be? Well, it's convenient to split them into three parts. Symmetric, traceless, antisymmetric, and trace. So we can put sort of some symmetric, traceless, component, some antisymmetric, and some trace. If you look at this component, it's a traceless symmetric tensor, massless. This describes fluctuations of a graviton. This gauge symmetry is simply the gauge symmetry of a graviton, the diffeomorphism invariance of a graviton. The other two are a bit more mysterious. This one describes an antisymmetric tensor, massless. It's called the Kalbermont field. It's really a spin two generalization of a photon. It's the sort of field which could be, so the photon, electromagnetic field, is a field which can be sourced by particles. This is the natural field that can be sourced by a string. See, when you write the coupling of a particle to a gauge field, you write something like this. This is a field that can be coupled easily to a string. See, this is a coupling. In both cases, these are couplings which you can write without even needing a metric. I don't know if you've noticed. So the coupling of a gauge field to a particle trajectory is something you can write without ever mentioning a metric. The same is true for the coupling of this to a string. So in general, you've probably never encountered them before, but it's natural to consider higher generalizations of gauge fields, which have multiple antisymmetric indices and couple to extended objects. If you know what forms are, these are fields valued in a form. They actually do occur, even in condensed matter. Anyway, and then you get something which is a scalar field, which we call the dilaton. This massless scalar field will turn out to control the strength of the interaction between the strings. So these are the most interesting fields, because they're the massless ones. They're the ones which survive at low energy, no matter what you do. Then on top of these, you're going to find big towers of more complicated fields. For example, I could do something like this. These fields will be physical when t squared is equal to minus 2. Actually, I could probably restore the tension, which I had secretly put to 1. So these describe excitations which are massive, as a mass is determined by the tension of the string. And at low energy, they will just go away. So at low energy, the string bosonic string theory looks like a theory of some gravitons and true form and scalar field in 26-dimensional flat space, plus massive stuff, plus, unfortunately, a tachyon, a very tachyonic field. So again, there is a T here. Now, clearly, the truly important and interesting part is the appearance of the graviton.
What do you mean by there's a T there?
The tension. See, saying that the momentum is 2 is a little bit inappropriate. It just meant that I went in some funny units. If I use general units, then I should put a dimensionful quantity here, which is the tension of the string. Okay, any more questions?
So we did some gauge fixing earlier for the reparameterization invariance,
that's right.
But do we still have like some residual gauge degrees of freedom here? Or?
Right, good point. Sorry. There are two meanings of the word gauge symmetry here. So one is indeed this reparameterization we had on the worksheet. Okay, so that's a gauge symmetry for this on the worksheet. Then we had this Hilbert space of the string theory, which was made of physical states modulo states which are also null. If I just look at the physical states, they look like something I can collect together into a field. Right? If I try to describe string theory as a quantum field theory with a collection of fields, this set of fields are in one-to-one correspondence with modes of some scalar field, which satisfies in space-time something like this. Okay. These modes, all of them, all these physical modes can be naturally associated, these modes can be naturally associated to a graviton, or at least an infinitesimal fluctuation of a graviton, which again satisfies some equations of motion, some local equation of motion. But not all of these modes are string modes. We should throw away the null states. So in quantum field theory, when you have a physical system whose excitations are modes of some field, modulo something, you call that a gauge symmetry in quantum field theory. So in here, for example, if you want to throw away the modes, the null states, we would say that this delta G is defined up to shift by a del mu in mu plus del mu in mu. So that would be a gauge symmetry, but now in space-time.
Okay.
A redundancy of a description in terms of... So yeah, what is gauge symmetry? Gauge symmetry is not a symmetry. It's nothing intrinsic. Gauge symmetry is just a redundancy of your description. It means that if you want to describe a quantum field theory in terms of local fields, you typically have too many excitations and you need to add a local gauge symmetry to get the true theory. This redundancy manifests itself in space-time as precisely this type of gauge symmetry.
Mm-hmm. Should low energy correspond to high tension?
Yes. That's right. So the tension has units of momentum squared or 1/length squared.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm still a bit confused. So like the redundancies that we got rid of earlier were mm-hmm. coming from reparametrizations of the world sheet.
That's right.
But here we have some extra redundancies that don't have anything to do with that, right?
Well, I wouldn't say they have nothing to do with that. These were redundancy also from the point of view of the reparametrization. See, these null states are states which are produced from another state by a conformal transformation, which is what's left of the diffeomorphism times Weyl. So these are redundancy in that sense. They are also redundancy. If you give a quantum field theory interpretation, then they become redundancy in the sense of gauge symmetry in space-time. So the same redundancy can be given a different interpretation if you're thinking about it in terms of the string worksheet or in terms of some quantum fields which are modeling the string theory.
Okay.
So when I start organizing the string modes into quantum fields, I'm just giving new names to all sorts of things. And the new name for the null vectors is gauge symmetries. Okay.